What you don't see, I said, is that humans can find an inner motivation to create good in the world. He laughed cynically. Surely you don't believe that. Nothing in history would suggest that people are anything other than selfish and greedy. If you had your own spirituality, you would see the good. My voice was rising in anger, too. No, he snapped, almost screaming. Spirituality is the problem. As long as there is religion, there cannot be unity among people. Don't you understand? Each religious institution is like an inflexible roadblock on the path of progress. Each wars with the other. The Christians spend all their time and money wanting to convert everyone into their doctrine of judgmentalness. The Jews want to remain isolated in a dream of chosenness. The Muslims think it's about camaraderie and collective power and holy hatred. And we in the East, we are the worst. We disregard the real world for a fanciful inner life no one can understand. With all this chaos of metaphysics, no one can focus on progress, on easing the burden of the poor, on seeing that every Tibetan child is educated. But don't worry, he went on. We are going to see that the problem is resolved, and you have helped us. Ever since Wilson James visited you in America, we've monitored your movements and the movements of the Dutch group. I knew you would come, that you would be involved. I must have looked surprised. Oh, yes, we have known all about you. We operate more freely in America than you think. Your NSA can monitor the Internet. Do you think we cannot? You and this sect will never elude me. How do you think we could follow you in this weather? It was by power of mind. My mind. It came to me where you would be. Even after we were lost in this wilderness, I knew. I could feel your presence. At first, it was your friend Yen whom I could follow. Now, it's been you. And that's not all. I don't even need to use my instincts to locate you anymore. I have your brainwave scan. He nodded toward the door. In a matter of minutes, our technicians will have mounted our new surveillance equipment. Then, we'll be able to locate anyone we have scanned. At first, I couldn't remember what he was referring to, but then I recalled my experience at the Chinese house in Ali after I was gassed. The soldiers had put me under a machine. A new wave of fear raced through me, but it turned immediately into an even deeper anger. You're mad, I screamed. That's right. To you, I'm crazy, but I'm the future. He was towering over me now, his face red, virtually exploding with anger. Such stupid innocence. You're going to tell me everything, you understand? Everything. I knew that he would not have given me all this information if he planned to ever release me, but at the moment, I didn't care. I was talking to a monster, and an overwhelming rage was filling me. I was about to verbalize his damnation again when a voice from the other side of the room called out. Don't! It weakens you! The colonel turned and stared, and I followed his gaze. There by the door stood another guard, and beside him, something against a small table, was Yen. The guard pushed him to the floor. I jumped up and raced over to Yen as the colonel said something in Chinese to the guards, then stormed out. Yen had bruises and cuts on his face. Yen, are you all right? I asked, helping him over to a cot. I'm okay, he said, pulling me down to sit on the cot beside him. They came for us right after you left. His eyes were full of excitement. Tell me what happened. Did you reach Shambhala? I looked at him and held my fingers to my lips. They probably put us together to see what we would say, I whispered. You can bet they have this place bugged. We shouldn't talk. We'll have to risk it for a deeper reason, Yen said. Come over by the heater. It's noisy. Tell me what happened. For the next half hour, I told him all about the world I had found in Shambhala. Then, in the barest whisper, I mentioned the temples. His eyes grew wider. So you haven't found all of the fourth extension? I mouthed. It's at the temples. I went on to tell him about Tashi and Will, and what Ani had said about learning what those in the temples were doing. And what else did she say? Yin asked. She said we must have no enemies, I replied. Yin grimaced in pain for a moment and then said, But you are doing exactly that with the colonel. You were using your anger and disdain to feel strong. Those are mistakes I made. You're lucky he did not kill you immediately. I slumped back, knowing my emotions were out of control. Don't you remember when your negative expectation drove away the Dutch couple in the van, and you missed an important synchronicity? In that case, you were having a fear expectation that they were perhaps going to do you harm. They felt that expectation on your part and probably began to feel that if they stopped, they would be doing something wrong, so they left. Yes, I remember. Every negative assumption or expectation, Yin continued, that we make about another human being is a prayer that goes out and acts to create that reality in that person. Remember, our minds connect. Our thoughts and expectations go out and influence others to think the same way that we do. That's what you have been doing with the colonel. You have been expecting him to be evil. Wait a minute. I was just seeing him the way he is. Really? What part of him? His ego or his higher soul self? Yin was right. All this was something I thought I'd learned with the 10th insight, but I wasn't acting on it. When I was running from him, I said, he was able to follow me. He said he could do it with his mind and intuition. Were you thinking of him? Yin asked, expecting him to follow you. I must have been. Don't you remember? That's what was happening with me earlier, and now you are doing the same thing. That expectation was creating the thoughts in Chang's mind of where you were. It was an ego thought, but it came to him because you were expecting, praying, in effect, for him to find you. Don't you see, Yin continued, we've talked about this so many times. Our prayer field is working constantly in the world, sending out our expectations, and in the case of another person, the effect is almost instantaneous. Luckily, as I said before, such a negative prayer is not as strong as a positive prayer, because you immediately cut yourself off from your higher self energies, but it still has an effect. This is the hidden process behind your golden rule. I looked at him for a moment, not understanding. I took a minute to remember what he was referring to. The Bible injunction to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I couldn't exactly see the connection and asked him to explain. The rule sounds, Yin went on, as though it should be kept because it creates a good society, right? As an ethical stance. But the fact is, there is a real spiritual, energetic, karmic reason that goes beyond the notion that this is a good idea. It is important to keep this rule because you are affected personally. He paused dramatically, then added, The more complete expression of this rule should be, do unto others the way you would have them do unto you, because how you treat them or think about them is exactly how they are going to treat you. The prayer that you send out with your feeling or action tends to bring out in them exactly what you expect. I nodded. This idea was starting to sink in. In the case of the colonel, when you conclude he is evil, your prayer energy goes out and enters his energy and adds to his tendencies. And so he begins to act the way you expect him to act, in an angry, ruthless manner. Because he isn't connected with a deeper divine energy, his ego energy is weak and malleable. He takes on the role you expect of him. Think back to how things generally operate in human culture. This effect is everywhere. Remember that we humans share attitudes and moods. It's all very contagious. When we look out at others and make judgments, thinking that they are fat or thin or underachieved or ugly or poorly dressed, we actually send our energy out at these people, and they often begin to think bad thoughts about themselves. We are engaging in what can only be called the energy of evil. It is the contagion of negative prayer. But what are we supposed to do? I protested. Don't we have to see things as they are? Of course we have to see things the way they are. But after that, we must immediately shift our expectations from what is to what could be. In the case of the colonel, you should have realized that even though he was acting evilly, cut off from anything spiritual, his higher self was capable of seeing the light in an instant. That's the expectation you want to hold, because then you are really sending your prayer field out to lift his energy and awareness in that direction. You must return to that mental posture always, no matter what you see. He paused dramatically, smiling, which I thought was strange given our situation and his bruised and cut face. They beat you? I asked. It's nothing I haven't wished on them, he said, making his point one more time. Do you see how important all this is? Yen asked. You cannot go further with the extension until you understand this. Anger will always be a temptation. It feels good. It makes our egos think we are becoming stronger. You have to be smarter than that. You cannot reach the strongest levels of creative energy until you can avoid negative prayer of all kinds. There is enough evil out there without adding to it unconsciously. This is the great truth behind the Tibetan code of compassion. I looked away, knowing that all Yin was saying was true. I had slipped into this pattern of anger again. Why did I keep doing this over and over? Yin caught my eye. Here is the cap to this idea. In correcting a counterproductive pattern in oneself, in our case, anger and condemnation, it is imperative not to put out a negative prayer about our own possibilities. Do you see what I mean? If we make self-defeating comments such as, I can't overcome this problem, or I'll always be this way, then we are in fact praying to stay the way we are. We have to hold a vision that we will find a higher energy and overcome our patterns. We have to uplift ourselves with our own prayer energy. He leaned back on the cot. This is the lesson I myself had to learn. I could never understand the attitude of compassion that Lama Rigdon held toward the Chinese government. They were destroying our country, and I wanted them vanquished. I had never been close enough to any of the soldiers to look in their eyes, to see them as people caught up in a tyrannical system. But once I saw past their egos, their socialization, I could finally learn not to add to the energy of evil with my negative assumptions. I could finally hold a higher vision for them and myself. Perhaps because I have learned this, I can also hold a higher vision that you will learn it also. I awoke with the first noise in the camp. Someone was clanking barrels or large cans together. I jumped up, dressed, and glanced toward the door. The guards had been replaced by two other soldiers. They stared at me sleepily. I walked over and looked out the window. The day was dark and overcast, and the wind howled. There was movement at one of the other tents. One of the doors was opening. It was the colonel, and he was walking toward our tent. I moved back to Yen's cot, and he turned over, struggling to wake up. His face was swollen, and he squinted to see me. The colonel is coming back, I said. I will help as much as I can, he said. But you will have to hold a different prayer field for him. It is your only chance. The flap door tore open and the soldiers jumped to attention. The colonel came in and gestured for them to wait outside. He glanced at Yen once before walking over to me. I was taking deep breaths and attempting to extend my field as much as possible. I visualized the energy flowing out from me, and I focused on seeing him not as a torturer, but only as a soul in fear. "I want to know where these temples are," he said, in a low, ominous voice, taking off his coat. "The only way you can see them is if your energy is high enough," I replied, voicing the first thing that came to my mind. He seemed to be taken off guard. "What are you talking about? You told me you believe in powers of the mind. What if one of those powers is to raise your energy level?" "What energy?" "You said that brain waves were real and could be manipulated by a machine. What if they could be manipulated internally by our intention and made stronger, raising your energy level?" "How is that possible?" he said. "Nothing like that has ever been shown by science." I couldn't believe it. He seemed to be opening his mind. I focused on the expression on his face that seemed to be honestly considering what I was saying. "But it's really possible," I went on. "Brainwaves, or perhaps a different set of waves that go farther, can be increased to a point where we can influence what happens." He perked up. "Are you telling me you now know how to use brainwaves to make certain things happen?" As he talked, I again saw a glow behind him against the wall of the tent. "Yes," I continued, "but only those things that take our lives in the direction they are supposed to go. Otherwise, the energy eventually collapses." "Supposed to go?" he asked, squinting. The area of the tent behind him continued to appear lighter, and I couldn't help glancing at it. He turned around and looked in that direction himself. "What are you looking at?" he asked. "Tell me what you mean about supposed to go. I consider myself free. I can take my life anywhere I want." "Yes, of course that's true, but there is a direction that feels best, is more inspired, and gives you more satisfaction than all others, isn't there?" I couldn't believe how light the area behind him was becoming, but I dared not look at it directly. "I don't know what you are talking about," he said. He looked confused, but I remained focused on the part of his expression that was listening. "We are free," I said, "but we also belong to a design that comes from a greater part of ourselves that we can connect with. Our true self is much larger than we thought." He just stared. Somewhere, deep in his consciousness, he seemed to be understanding. We were interrupted when the guards outside banged on the entrance flap. As they did, I realized that the wind had erupted into a gale. We could hear things being blown and turned over all through the compound. A guard had opened the flap and was shouting loudly in Chinese. The colonel ran toward him. As he did, we could see tents blowing over everywhere. He turned and looked at Yen and me, and in that moment, a tremendous gust of wind blew the left side of our tent up from its foundation and ripped it apart, covering the colonel and guard with canvas, knocking them to the ground. Yen and I were hit with the wind and snow blowing in through the gaping hole. "Yen," I shouted, "the Dakini!" Yen struggled to his feet. "This is your chance," he said. "Run!" "Come on," I said, grabbing his arm. "We can go together." He pushed me away. "I can't. I'll just slow you down." "We can make it," I pleaded. He shouted against the howling wind. "I've done what I was here to do. Now you must do the same. We still don't know the rest of the fourth extension." I nodded and embraced him quickly, then grabbed the colonel's heavy coat and ran through the hole in the tent into the storm. Acknowledging the light. I ran to the north for about 100 feet and stopped to look back toward the camp. I could still hear the sounds of debris blowing through the compound and the din of shouting. Out ahead of me was a solid sheet of white, and I was trudging back toward the mountains when I heard the colonel yell, I will find you, he shouted angrily above the wind. You won't make it. I walked on, hurrying as much as possible in the deep snow. It took me 15 minutes to walk 100 yards. Fortunately, the wind was still fierce, and I knew it would be some time before the Chinese could get their helicopters into the air. I heard a faint sound. At first, I thought it was the wind, but it gradually became louder. I hunkered down. Someone was calling my name. Finally, I could see someone moving in the blowing snow. It was Will. I embraced him. God, am I glad to see you. How did you find me? I watched the direction the chopper flew in, he said, and just kept walking until I saw the camp. I've been out here all night. If I hadn't had my camp stove with me, I would have frozen to death. I was trying to figure out how to get you out of there, but the blizzard solved that problem. Come on. We have to try again to get to the temples. I hesitated. What's wrong? Will asked. Yin's in there, I replied. He's hurt. Will thought for a moment as we looked back toward the compound. They will be organizing a search party, he said. We can't go back. We'll have to try to help him later. If we don't get out of here and find the temples before the colonel does, everything could be lost. What happened to Tashi? I asked. We were separated when the avalanche started, Will replied, but I saw him later going on up the mountain alone. We walked for more than 2 hours, and strangely, once we got out of the area around the Chinese encampment, the wind began to die down, although it was still snowing heavily. During our trek, I told Will about everything that Yin had said in the tent and what had happened with the colonel. Finally, we reached the area on the mountain where the avalanche had occurred. We hiked well past it and to the west, farther up the slope. Without talking anymore, Will led the way upward for another 2 hours. Finally, he stopped and sat down to rest behind a huge bank of snow. We looked at each other for a long moment, both of us breathing hard. Will smiled and asked, "Do you now understand what Yin was telling you?" I was silent. Even though I had seen it all play out with the colonel, it still seemed hard to believe. "I was engaging in negative prayer," I said finally. "That's how the colonel was able to follow me." We can go no further until we can both avoid this, Will said. Our energy must stay consistently high before we can progress through the rest of the fourth extension. We must be very careful not to visualize the evilness of those who are in fear. We have to look at them realistically and take precautions. But if we dwell on their behavior and hold images that they are about to harm us, it sends energy to their paranoia and can actually give them the idea to do whatever it is that we expect. That's why it is so important not to let our minds visualize the bad things that could possibly happen to us. It is a prayer that acts to create that very event. I shook my head, knowing I was still resisting this idea. If it was true, it seemed to put a high burden on each of us to watch every thought. I voiced my concern to Will. He almost laughed. Of course we must monitor every thought. We have to do that in order not to miss an important intuition anyway. Besides, all that is necessary is to go back to a conscious alertness and always to visualize everyone's awareness being increased. The legends are very clear. To keep our prayer energy extended most powerfully, we must never allow ourselves to use it negatively. We can go no farther until we can avoid this problem completely. How many of the legends were described to you? I asked. In answering my question, Will began to talk about his experiences during this adventure in greater detail than he had been able to before. When I came to your house, he began, I was bewildered as to why my energy had fallen from where it was when we were exploring the tenth insight. Then I began to have thoughts of Tibet and found myself at the monastery of Lama Rigdon, where I met Yin and heard of the dreams. I didn't understand it all, but I had similar dreams myself. I knew that you were involved somehow and had something to do here. That's when I began to study the legends in detail and to learn the prayer extensions. I was all set to meet you in Kathmandu, but I caught the Chinese following me, so I asked Yin to go instead. I had to trust that we would eventually find each other. Will paused a moment and dug out a white undershirt and began to put a new dressing on his knee. I looked out at the infinite expanse of white mountains behind us. The clouds parted for an instant, and the morning sun created a rippling effect of light ridgetops and darker, shadowed valleys. The sight filled me with awe, and in a strange way, I began to feel at home here, as though some part of me finally understood this land. When I looked back at Will, he was staring at me. "Perhaps," Will said, "we should go over all that the legends say about the prayer field. We must understand how all this connects together." I nodded. "It all begins," he went on, "with the realization that our prayer energy is real, that it goes out from us and affects the world. Once we have that realization, we can grasp that this field, this effect we have on the world, can be expanded. But we have to begin with the first extension. We have to first improve the quality of energy we take in physically. Heavy and processed foods build up acid solids in our molecular structures, lowering our vibration and eventually causing disease. Alive foods have an alkaline effect and enhance our vibration. The purer we vibrate, the easier it is to then connect with the more subtle energies available within us. The legends say we will learn to consistently breathe in this higher level of energy using our increased perception of beauty as a measure. The higher our level of energy, the more beauty we see. We can learn to visualize this higher level of energy flowing out from us into the world. Likewise, using the emotional state of love as a measure that this is occurring. Thus, we are connected within like we learned in Peru. Only now we've learned that by visualizing that energy as a field that goes out ahead of us wherever we go, we can stay consistently stronger. The second extension begins when we set this extended prayer field to enhance the synchronistic flow of our lives. We do this by staying in a state of conscious alertness and expectation for the next intuition or coincidence that moves our lives further along. This expectation sends our energy out even farther and makes it stronger, because we are now aligning our intentions with the intended process of growth and evolution structured into the universe itself. The third extension involves another expectation, that our prayer field goes out and boosts the level of energy in others, lifting them into their own connection with the divine within and into their own higher self-intuition. This, of course, increases the likelihood of them giving us intuitive information that can further enhance our own level of synchronicity. It is the interpersonal ethic we learned in Peru, only now we know how to use the prayer field to make it stronger. The fourth extension begins when we learn the importance of anchoring and maintaining the outflow of our energy, in spite of fearful or angry situations. We do this by always maintaining a particular posture of detachment toward events as they occur, even as we expect the process itself to carry on. We must always seek a positive meaning and always, always expect the process to save us, no matter what is happening. Such a mental posture helps us to stay focused on the flow and keeps us from dwelling on negative images of what might occur if we fail. In general, if we find a negative image coming to mind, we must consider whether it is an intuitive warning, and if so, we need to take appropriate actions. But we must always return to the expectation that our higher synchronicity will guide us past this problem. This anchors our field, our outflow of energy, with a powerful expectation that has always been called faith. In sum, the first part of the fourth extension is about keeping our energy strong at all times. Once we master that, we can move forward and extend our energy even farther. The next step in the fourth extension begins when we fully expect that the human world can move toward the ideal expressed in the tenth insight and modeled by Shambhala. Moving your energy out farther and stronger in this way takes true belief. That's why understanding Shambhala is so important. Knowing that Shambhala has done it extends our expectation that the rest of human culture can do it too. we can readily see how humans everywhere can master our technology and use it in the service of our spiritual development, and then begin to focus on the life process itself, on the real reason we are here on this planet. To create a culture on Earth that is conscious of our role in spiritual evolution, and to teach that understanding to our children. He stopped and looked at me for a moment. Now comes the most difficult part, he said. To expand even farther, we must do more than just remain positive in general and avoid images of negative events occurring. We must also keep all negative thoughts out of our heads concerning other people. As you have just seen, if our fear ever turns to anger and we lapse into thinking the worst of others, a negative prayer goes out that tends to bring in them exactly the behavior we expect. That's why teachers who expect great things from their students usually get it. And when they expect the negative, they get that too. Most people believe it is a bad thing to say something negative about others, but that it's okay to think them. We now know it's not okay. Thoughts matter. As Will said this, I thought about the recent spate of school shootings by students in the United States and mentioned what I was thinking to Will. Kids everywhere, he said, are more powerful than ever, and the typical cliques and put-downs that have always occurred in schools can't be ignored by teachers any longer. When certain kids are looked down on and made fun of and scapegoated, they are affected by this negative prayer more than ever before. They now sometimes strike back explosively. And this is not just happening with kids. It's happening throughout human culture. Only by understanding the effect of prayer field can we grasp what is happening. We are all gradually growing more powerful, and if we don't become completely mindful of our expectations, we can inadvertently cause great harm to others. Will stopped talking and raised his eyebrow. That brings us up to where we are now, I believe. I nodded, realizing how much I had missed him. Where do the legends say we go from here? I asked. To the subject I have been most interested in, he replied. The legends say that we can't expand our fields farther until we fully acknowledge the Dakini. I quickly told him about my many experiences with the strange figures and lighted areas since coming to Tibet. You had those experiences before Tibet, Will said. He was right. There were times when we were looking for the tenth insight that I seemed to be helped by strange wisps of light. That's right, I said, when we were together in the Appalachians. In Peru, too, he added. I tried to remember, but nothing came to mind. You told me about the time you faced a crossroads and didn't know which way to go, he said. And one road appeared more lit up, more luminous, and you chose that direction. Yes, I said, remembering the occurrence clearly. You think that was the Dakini? Will was standing on his feet, putting on his pack. Yes, he said. They are the luminosities we see that guide our way. I was dumbfounded. That meant that whenever we experience a luminous object or a pathway that seems brighter and more attractive, or a book that jumps out at us and draws our attention to it, it was the work of these beings. What else do the legends say about the Dakini? I asked. That they are the same for every culture, every religion, no matter what we call them. I gave him a questioning look. We could call them angels, Will continued. But no matter whether they are called Dakini or angels, they are the same beings, and they do their work in the same way. I had another question to ask, but Will was hurrying up the slope, avoiding the areas of heavy snow. I followed, dozens of questions coming to my mind. I didn't want to let the conversation go. At one point, Will glanced back at me. The legends say that these beings have aided humans since the beginning of time, and they are spoken of in the mystical literature of every religion. According to the legends, each of us will begin to perceive them more readily. If we really acknowledge them, the Dakini will make themselves more known. The way he was stressing the word acknowledge made me think it had a special meaning. But how do we do this? I asked, climbing over a rock that was jutting out into the path. Will stopped above me and let me catch up, then said, "According to the legends, we have to really acknowledge that they are there. That is very difficult for our modern minds to do. It is one thing to think that Akini, or angels, are a fascinating subject matter. It is another thing altogether to expect them to be perceivable in our lives. What are you saying we should do? Watch alertly for every shade of luminosity." "So if we keep our energy high and acknowledge them," I said, "then we can begin to see more of the luminosities?" "That's right," he said. "The hard part is training ourselves to look for the subtle changes in the light around us. But if we do, we can detect it more." I thought about what he was saying, and I understood as far as it went, but I still had a question. "What about the cases," I asked, "of the Akini or angels intervening directly in our lives when we aren't expecting them or acknowledging them? This has happened to me." I went on to tell Will about the tall figure that had been there when Yin pushed me out of the jeep north of Ali, and it showed up again when the campfire appeared at the ruined monastery before I entered Shambhala. Will was nodding. "It appears your guardian angel has shown himself. The legends say each of us has one." I paused, looking at him. "Then the myths are true," I said finally. "We each have a guardian angel." My mind was going 100 miles an hour. The reality of these beings had never been so clear. "But what makes them help us at certain times?" I asked, "and not others?" Will raised his eyebrow. "That," he said, "is the secret we are here to discover." We were reaching the summit of the mountain. Behind us, the sun was beginning to break through the thick overcast, and it felt as if the temperature was warming. "I was told," Will said, stopping just short of the mountain's top, "that the temples are on the other side of this ridge." He stopped and looked at me. "This may be the hardest part." His words sounded ominous to me. "Why?" I asked. "What do you mean?" "We have to put all the extensions together and keep our energy as strong as possible. The legends say that only if we are able to keep our energy high enough will we be able to see the temples." At exactly this moment, we heard helicopters somewhere in the distance. The sound chilled me. "And don't forget what you just learned," Will said. "If you start to think about the evil in the Chinese military, if you feel anger or disgust, you must shift your attention immediately to the soul in each soldier that can emerge. Visualize your energy flowing out from you and entering their fields, lifting them into a connection with the light inside, so that they can discover their higher intuitions. To do otherwise is to send a prayer out that gives them more energy to be evil." I nodded and looked down. I was determined to maintain this positive field. "Now, go beyond that to acknowledge the Akini and expect the luminosities." I looked out at the summit just ahead, and Will nodded and led the way forward. When we reached the crest, we could see nothing on the other side except a series of snow-covered peaks and valleys. We surveyed the scene carefully. "Over there," Will yelled, pointing to our left. I strained to see. Something at the edge of the crest seemed to be shimmering slightly. When I tried to focus on it directly, all I saw was that the area seemed luminous. But when I looked at it through the corner of my eye, I could tell that the space itself was shimmering. "Let's go," Will said. He pulled my arm and we made our way across the deep snow and up to the spot we'd seen. As we walked closer, the area seemed to grow brighter still. Beyond it was a series of huge, rocky spires that looked from a distance to be lined up side by side. Upon closer inspection, however, we found that one was set back from the others, leaving a narrow passage that bent around farther to the left and down the slope of the mountain. When we reached the passage, we discovered that there were actually stone steps hewn into the rocks that led the way downward. The steps also appeared luminous and were clear of snow. The Dakini are showing us where to go, Will said, still pulling me along. We ducked through the opening and followed the descending pathway. On both sides, a sheer rock face rose upwards 20 or 30 feet and blocked out most of the light. For more than an hour, we walked down the steps, steadily descending, until at last the cliffs widened above our heads. Several yards farther, the ground leveled off and the steps ended. We found ourselves looking out on a flat precipice that wrapped around the rock face to the left. Over there, Will said, pointing. 200 yards ahead of us appeared to be an old monastery, totally in ruin as if it were thousands of years old. As we walked toward it, the temperature warmed even more and a misty ground fog rose from the rocks. In front of the monastery, the precipice widened into a wide shelf that cut into the side of the mountain. When we reached the ruins, we carefully made our way through the collapsed walls and large stones until we emerged on the other side. There, we were stopped in our tracks. The rocky surface we were walking on turned to a floor of smooth, flat stones, light amber in color that were evenly placed onto the ground beneath our feet. I glanced at Will, who was looking straight ahead. In front of us was an intact temple, standing 50 feet high and twice that wide. It was rusty brown with streaks of gray along the joints of the pitted stone walls. On the front were two mammoth doors 15 or 20 feet high. Something moved in the misty fog near the temple. I looked at Will, and he nodded, motioning me to follow him. We walked to within 20 yards of the structure. What was that movement? I asked Will. He gestured with his head toward the area in front of us. Less than 10 feet away was a form of some kind. I strained to focus and finally was able to detect the barest outline of a human figure. It must be one of the adepts who inhabit the temples, Will said. The person is vibrating higher than us. That's why we can only see a hazy shape. As we watched, the shape moved toward the door of the temple and disappeared. Will led the way up to the door. It appeared to be made of some kind of stone, yet when Will pulled it by the carved stone knob, it glided open as though it weighed nothing. Inside was a large circular room, sloping downward in a series of terraced steps toward a center stage-like area. As I surveyed the structure, I caught sight of another figure halfway to the stage, only this person was clear to our perception. He turned so we could see his face. It was Tashi. Will was already moving in that direction. Before we reached Tashi, a spatial window appeared in a space just above the center of the room. The image slowly came into focus, captivating our attention and growing so bright we could no longer see Tashi. It was a view of the Earth seen from space. The scene shifted in quick succession to a view of a city somewhere in Europe, and then to a metropolitan area in the United States, and finally to one in Asia. In each case, we could see people walking on busy streets, as well as some in offices or other work environments. As the scene again shifted through different cities in different areas of the planet, we could see that the individuals, as they worked and interacted, were slowly raising their energy levels. We began to see and hear individuals involved in moving from one type of occupation to another, following their intentions, and growing more inspired and creative as they did so, inventing new and faster technologies and more efficient services. At the same time, we also began to see scenes of people who were still in fear, resisting the changes, and trying to gain control. Next, we focused on a research facility inside a conference room. A group of men and women was engaged in a heated exchange. As we watched and listened, the content of the conversation became clear. Most of the people were in favor of a new coalition between the larger communications and computer companies and an international coalition of intelligence services. The representatives of the intelligence services argued that the fight against terrorism necessitated having access to every telephone line, including internet communications, and secret identification devices in all computers so that authorities could go in and monitor anyone's files. But that wasn't all. They wanted more surveillance systems. Several of the people were even speculating that if the problem of computer viruses continued, the Internet might have to be taken over completely, along with all linked computers in commerce everywhere. Access could be controlled by a special ID number that would be required in order to do any electronically based business. One hypothesized that new identification systems might have to be implemented for this use, such as iris or palm scans, or perhaps even something based on brainwave patterns themselves. Two other people, a man and a woman, started arguing vehemently against these measures. One mentioned the Book of Revelation and the Mark of the Beast. As we continued to watch and listen, I realized I could see through the window of the conference room. A car was passing along a road outside the building. In the background, I could see cactus and miles of desert. I looked at Will. "This discussion is happening right now," he said, "in present time somewhere. It looks like the southwestern United States." Directly behind the table where the group was gathered, I noticed something else. The space around them was becoming larger. No, it was becoming lighter. "The Dakini," I said to Will. We continued to watch as the conversation began to change. The two people who were arguing against the extreme surveillance seemed to be gaining more attention from the group. The proponents seemed to be reconsidering. Without warning, our attention was pulled away from the image in front of us by a sharp vibration that shook the floor and walls of the temple. We ran for another door at the end of the building, fighting to see through the dust. We could hear stones crumbling and falling outside. When we were 30 feet from the door, it opened, and a figure we couldn't make out quickly moved through it. "That must have been Tashi," Will said, as he rushed to the door and pulled it open. As we ran through the opening, another booming crash filled the air behind us. The old ruin we had first seen was collapsing in an implosion of rocks and dust. Behind it somewhere, we could hear the roar of helicopters. "The Colonel seemed to be following us again," I said. "But I'm holding only positive images in my mind, so how is he doing that?" Will looked at me questioningly, and I remembered Colonel Chang's remark about how he now had the technology so that I could never get away. He had my brain scan. I quickly told Will what had happened, then said, "Maybe I should go in another direction, lead the soldiers out of the temples." "No," Will said. "You have to be here. You're going to be needed. We'll have to stay ahead of them until we find Tashi." We followed a stone pathway past several other temples, and I found my eyes lingering on a doorway to our left. Will turned, noticing. "Why were you looking at that door?" he asked. "I don't know," I replied. It caught my eye." He gave me an incredulous look. "Oh, yeah, right," I said quickly. "Let's check it out." We ran inside, and I found another circular room, this one much larger, perhaps several hundred feet in diameter. Another spatial window was hovering over the center. As we entered, I saw Tashi to our right, a few yards away, and nudged Will. "I see him," Will said, leading the way in the near darkness to join the boy. Tashi turned around and saw us, then smiled in relief before focusing again on the scene visible through the window. This time, we were seeing a room filled with the things of youth. Pictures, balls, various games, piles of clothes. A bed was in disarray in the corner, and a carry-out pizza box littered one end of a table. At the other end of the table, a teenager of about 15 worked on something, some kind of wired apparatus. He was dressed in shorts without a shirt, and his face seemed angry and determined. As we continued to watch, the scene through the window shifted to another room, where another teenager, dressed in jeans and a sweatshirt, sat on a bed staring at a phone. He got up and paced across the room several times and then sat down again. I got the impression that he was struggling with the decision. Finally, he picked up the phone and dialed a number. At that point, the window widened so that we could see both scenes. The boy with no shirt answered the phone. The youth in the sweatshirt seemed to be pleading, and the other boy grew ever more angry. Finally, the shirtless boy slammed down the phone, sat down, and began working at the table again. The other teenager got up and put on a coat and hurried out the door. In a few minutes, the boy at the table heard a knock and got up and walked over to the door of his room and opened it. It was the youth he had been talking to on the phone. He tried to shut the door, but the boy pushed his way in, continuing to talk to him in pleading gestures, pointing at the apparatus on the table. The other teenager pushed him back and pulled a gun from a drawer and pointed it at his visitor. This boy stepped back but continued to plead. The youth with the gun exploded with anger and pushed his victim hard against the wall, placing the barrel of the gun against his temple. At this moment, in the area behind them both, we began to detect a change. The area was getting lighter. I glanced at Tashi, who met my gaze for an instant and then focused again on the scene. We both knew we were again witnessing the Dakini at work. As we watched, the one boy continued to plead, and the other held him firm against the wall. But gradually, the boy with the gun began to relax. Finally, he dropped the gun to his side and went over and sat on the edge of the bed. The other youth sat down in a chair facing him. Now we could hear the details of their conversation, and it became clear that the boy who had the gun wanted to be accepted by others at his school, but had not been. Many of his peers were excelling at extracurricular activities, expanding their talent, and he didn't have the confidence to keep up. They had been kidding him, calling him a loser, and he felt as though he was a nobody, that he was fading away. The situation filled him with anger and a false sense of strength, which had led him to decide to fight back. The device he had been working on was a homemade bomb. Just as before, we felt a jolt under our feet, and the whole building shook. We all ran for the door and had just made it out when half the temple collapsed behind us. Tashi motioned for us to follow him, and we ran several hundred yards and stopped beside a wall. "Could you see the people in the temple?" he asked. "The ones who were sending prayer energy to the boys." We both confessed we could not. "There were hundreds in there," he said, "working on the problem of youth anger." "What were they doing exactly?" I asked. Tashi stepped toward me. "They were extending their prayer energy, visualizing the boys in that scene lifted into a higher vibration so they could move past their fear and anger and find their higher intuitions to resolve the situation. Their energy helped the one youth find the best, most persuasive ideas. In the case of the other youth, the extra prayer energy lifted him into an identity above and beyond the social self his peers rejected. He no longer felt that in order to be someone, he needed their approval. It eased his anger." "And that's what they were doing in the other temple as well?" I asked. "Helping to counter those who want to control everything?" Will looked at me. "The people in the temple were sending out a prayer field aimed at helping to raise the energy level of everyone involved, which had the effect of easing the fear of those who were pressing for ever more surveillance and helping those who were resisting to find the courage to speak, even within those kinds of organizations." Tashi was nodding. "We are supposed to be seeing this. These are some of the key situations that must be won if spiritual evolution is to continue, if we are to get past this critical point in history." "What about the Dakini?" I asked. "What are they doing?" "They were helping lift the energy level as well," Tashi replied. "Yeah," I pressed, "but we still don't know what makes them go there and take action. Those in the temples were doing something else we don't know yet." At that moment, another loud noise filled the air as the other half of the temple behind us crashed to the ground. Tashi jumped involuntarily, then hurried down the pathway. "Come on," he said. "We have to find my grandmother." XI. The Secret of Shambhala. For hours, we wandered through the temples, looking for Tashi's grandmother, hurrying to stay ahead of the Chinese military, and observing the work those in the temples were doing. In each temple, we found people viewing a situation in the outer cultures that seemed critical. One temple was focused on other problems related to youth alienation, the proliferation of violent experiences induced by movies and killer video games, which created the delusion that violent acts could be performed in anger and then erased somehow without being final, a false reality that was at the heart of the school shootings. In these instances, we watched as the creators of these games were each sent energy that had the effect, as before, of lifting them into a higher intuitive perspective with which they could rethink the effects of their creations on children. At the same time, key parents were likewise being lifted into higher energy states where they could investigate their hunches about what their children were doing and find more time to model a different reality. One temple focused on the current debate within the field of medicine over alternative preventive approaches, approaches that were being proved to be beneficial in the elimination of disease and in the increase of longevity. The gatekeepers of medicine, the medical organizations of various countries, the heads of popular research clinics, the government institutes of health who dispensed large financial grants, the pharmaceutical companies, all operated out of an 18th century paradigm which fought the symptoms of disease without much thought about prevention. Their targets were various microbes, faulty genes, and runaway tumor cells, and most thought such problems were the inevitable results of aging. Under this point of view, the huge majority of grant money was going to the large research facilities looking for magic bullets, pharmaceuticals that could be patented and sold to kill the microbes, destroy the malignant cells, or somehow reprogram the genes. Almost no money was going into research to discover ways to boost the immune system and prevent such diseases. In one scene we watched, a conference meeting involving representatives from many medical fields. Some scientists were arguing that the entire field of medicine had to change its point of view if we were ever going to solve the riddle of human disease, including the arterial lesions of heart disease, the tumors of cancer, and the degenerative illnesses such as arthritis and lupus and MS. These scientists were arguing, as Hahn had earlier, that the true cause of disease of every type was the polluting of the body's basic environment by the foods we were eating and other toxins, shifting the body from the healthy, vibrant, alkaline state of youth to a dull, low-energy acid state, which created a climate in which microbes flourish and begin to systematically decompose the body. Every ailment, they argued, is the result of this slow decomposition of our cells by microbes, but they don't attack us without cause. It is the foods we consume that set us up for these problems. Others in the room had trouble accepting these findings. Something had to be wrong, they thought. How could human illness be that simple? They were involved with health industries which saw consumers spending billions of dollars on complex drugs and expensive surgeries. The health officials in the room had to believe all this was necessary. Some were dedicated to the proposal, close to being accepted in many countries, that chips should be placed in every individual to store health and drug information, a control and identification ability that the intelligence services also wanted. They were committed to this program. Their positions of power depended on it. Their very livelihoods were at stake. Besides, they personally loved the food they ate. How could they recommend that people change their diets in ways they couldn't imagine doing themselves? No, they couldn't accept this. Still, the physicians with the new research continued to plead their case, knowing the climate was right to change the paradigm. Look at how the rainforests were being cleared and destroyed to raise beef for the Western countries, they argued, a problem ever more people were becoming aware of. Also helpful was the fact that baby boomers in all countries were beginning to reach ages when diseases strike, and they had already seen the medical establishment fail their parents. They were looking for new alternatives. Slowly, we saw the conflict begin to moderate in the conference room we were watching. Those arguing for the alternative approaches were being listened to. In another temple, we witnessed the same kind of debate in the profession of law. A group of attorneys was urging the profession to begin to police itself. For years, Reputable attorneys had stood by and watched many of their colleagues engage in the practice of manufacturing lawsuits, coaching witnesses to shade the truth, inventing imaginary defenses, and hypnotizing juries. Now, there was a movement to raise the standards.